Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
And we shall wonder if one day our game is played on the other planets. We will have interplanetary competition.
Your job now is to stand by our new manager.
I always said if I was Aladicio, they'd probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
If my granny had balls, he'd be my granddad.
Big Sam Aladicio, that's right. Yeah.
You're welcome, Max. So effectively, we're starting the football show early this evening. Pat Nevin is on the way after nine. We also have Dave McIntyre in discussion with David Myler, which is very good. Happened earlier this morning. We'll bring you that. We spoke to Graeme Hunter earlier on. We didn't quite realise, as I said before, the ad break there, that PK had been booed by Spanish fans since showing up for the game against Albania. So we only touch on PK to a point here, so you'll forgive that, I hope. But there's plenty to talk to Graeme about. I'm sure you've seen the scenes clearly at this stage. Over 800 people injured yesterday in Catalonia, disturbing scenes to say the least. Spanish riot police stormed polling stations, they seized ballot papers. The vote had been declared illegal. One school in Barcelona witness described police using axes to smash the doors, charge the crowds. There were rubber bullets fired. It was all really disturbing stuff. In the midst of it all, Barcelona beat Las Palmas, and it was a game which was played behind closed doors. This was not for security reasons. This was behind closed doors at the choosing of the Barcelona board. They requested of La Liga for the game not to go ahead. La Liga said, if the game doesn't go ahead, you will be hit with a 6-point reduction. So the game did go ahead ultimately, but the Barcelona board elected to play it behind closed doors as a form of protest. And it was on that decision that we started off with Graeme Hunter earlier on.
Some of the players wanted to play, some didn't. All of the board were behind the decision to ask both the Federation and the league to postpone the match. But once it became clear, and I think this was inevitable, once it became clear that the league was saying, we cannot and will not prejudice other clubs, prejudice Las Palmas, we cannot and will not postpone a game which is set against the backdrop of, judicially, an illegal referendum. As soon as that became clear, the board was split. So when the game goes ahead, we can't talk about what FC Barcelona did and didn't want to do as one big entity, because three board members left yesterday. It's a very febrile situation at the club right now. I don't think that as days go by, this will be without further footballing casualties. And at the end of the match, although Gerard Piqué had played very well, you know now that he broke down crying, which is simply extraordinary. One of the toughest guys, one of the meanest-minded guys, with a huge amount of brash self-confidence, a huge amount of success, for him to be so emotionally overcome about having had to play, about having seen these scenes of thuggish, jackboot, baton-wielding, rubber bullet firing national cops, to see him distraught like that tells you that to look for a unity of vision or decision or comprehension at Football Club Barcelona right now is a thankless task.
Mm. You might just expand on what is going on at board level then.
There were the pragmatists, first of all. Once the decision that it could not be postponed, the pragmatists said, what we will do is we will pact with the players and let majority rule. And it's clear that the majority of the players wanted to play.
Right.
Once they did that, they pacted with the players that they would accept the risk, in inverted commas, of playing a match which they needed to win, wanted to win, to maintain the gap of 7 points or 10 before Real Madrid played ahead of the champions, the gap that they've established on the reigning champions. The pragmatists between the board and the players said, if we play with no audience, the world's attention will be snagged, and this will be our protest against the brutal, I think, illegal actions of the national police.
Mm.
There were others who said that is far, far, far too short a measure. The only way to react to old men and women, young women, and then, you know, men of all ages, I distinguish that because in this society, there is definitely a hierarchy of who's important. And to see old men and women beaten and pushed to the ground and kicked took higher precedence here, maybe in your country too. than seeing men of your age, of Kev's age, of my age, being pushed around and being beaten. And there were people on the bus, on the board, and within the technical staff who wanted to cancel the game and say, to hell with the 6-point penalty, to hell with the possibility of losing the title to Real Madrid in due course because of that 6-point penalty. That those people, the non-pragmatists, the hardliners, said the only way to, and I have to say that while I think that the way to show defiance is to play and to win, when security was not at risk, when security comes into question, then that's a different matter. But sure. The local police, the Mossos, were not joining in the reprehensible scenes. The local police guaranteed the safety of the match as usual, and it was simply a protest to keep the Camp Nou empty, as you've detailed. At that point, my view is you play. You play, you win, and then you fight the battle that remains for you. Other people don't feel that way, and I have to say, being a non-Catalan, living in Barcelona, I'm pretty sure that I'm in the minority, or at least it seems that way, because across the society that I know, across colleagues that I know, across the printed and electronic media, and certainly amongst the hardliners of socios, they're calling this the most shameful game in the history of Barcelona. They're calling this a disgrace by the president and his board. Right. I think these words are harsh. I think it was a situation thrust upon a board that I don't have much time for. I will not speak often in their defence, but right now, for them to please everybody, to get the right pass, to do the right thing, was extraordinarily difficult. And I think they made a reasonable job of it, but they are being roundly condemned right now. And for that reason, that's why I say I think there'll be more casualties at board level. And that's why I think there's division at board level. And that's why I think the enemies of José María Bartomeu, who runs the club as president, the enemies will cynically seek to take advantage of his decision.
Yeah. Graham, given Gerard Piqué's very powerful interview post-match, given what he stands for and given his beliefs, in relation then to him continuing to play for Spain, meeting up with a squad this week for the Spanish games, do you see this being a big problem for him then going forward, personally?
This is a judgment call rather than fact, Kevin, and I'm going to judge no, simply because I know that what he said, I guess you've both witnessed what happened, and in the mix zone,
yeah.
Rather than him coming forward and trying to step away from Spain, he was being pushed again about the reaction that he knew would come from the Madrid media. Now, this has been Chinese water torture, the theory of which is that the drip, drip, drip will eventually drive you into submission, drive you mad. And while Gerard Piqué undoubtedly provokes some of this because he believes that he has a right to say and do what he feels, what he believes in, and everybody knows that if you stand because you will not kneel, you present a bigger target. Those who love to stand, those who won't kneel in life, they will be targeted and they will be sought out and they will be provoked. And he needs to take the consequences of being forthright and finding that he wants to speak about his democratic choices, not simply now, it's something that has branded his entire career. Now, as such, these issues that have been teased out this weekend have been things that his teammates at Spain level have known about for a long time. Things that Julen Lopetegui, who in his brief reign as Spain coach, has known about. You both know, your listeners and Off the Ball tonight know that for various reasons, some of which have been legitimate, some of which haven't, Piqué has been booed all around the country for Spain, whistled all around the country, and it's made him steadier, stronger. It's made him more intense. And he's been successful. I know from personal experience talking to him that he wants to play for Spain, that there is no weasel words about it matters to me, when in fact he's some sort of Catalan insurgent within the camp. It passionately matters to him. He wants to take Spain to the World Cup. And I'll tell you now that he and a group of players who've won trophies before believe that they are in with a shout of winning in Russia. Now, they've yet to get there. The game against Albania at home, although there is a desperate injury crisis, no Morata, no Carvajal, no Iniesta, this issue potentially, as you say, Kevin, chewing away at relationships. One, I think the squad will greet him as per normal and say, this is Gerard. Two, The coach will pick him. I'm sure of that. Three, I think it will not affect him in any way, psychologically or in a sporting sense, that this drama has enveloped his life this weekend. That's my judgment. I'm happy for you to call this back at me after the Albania game, after the game in Israel, and say, hey, look, you were wrong, but you've asked me. And that's my judgment based on my knowledge of the Spain setup, my knowledge of Lopetegui, and my knowledge of Gerard Piqué.
On the wider point, so Spain's Prime Minister talked about the police. He thanked them for acting with firmness and serenity, which I think stuck in the craw for most people. So he thanked the police for their firmness and serenity. The Catalan president, whose name I won't dare to pronounce at the moment, but police brutality, he said it will shame the Spanish state forever. You've outlined your interpretation of the scenes, and I think we would tend to agree with them. The really interesting thing is, so this vote, illegal and all as it was, there was no guarantee this was necessarily going to pass. It is not like there is a 95% swell for independence from Spain. There is no quicker way to radicalise an entire region than to set your police on them.
Yeah. I think that's stated and that's clear, and it might be that, you know, it might be that living in the island that you live in, you know that better than I do. However, Rajoy, who is the leading figure in Spanish centralist politics, in my view, took a very, very clear choice. He knows that there are hawks all around him. Those who vote for him, those in his party, the power that he hangs on to is by a very thin thread. And his decision was typical of the leaders we look at around, the idiot leaders we look at around the world, that fool Trump. It's all about me and self-betterment and power. And Rajoy went, if I damage Spain and Catalonia forever, if my name goes down against this disgrace forever and ever, at least what I'll be doing is feeding the hawks who, if I show lenience, if I don't act and send the cops in because a judge has said that the referendum is illegal, then I will lose power. And that's the single-minded, dwarf-like, gnome-like choice that he took. And I condemn him for it, but we see it everywhere. Me first, utilitarian aims second. It's a disgrace, but that's simply the way it is. And I hope that what will happen is that he'll have been wrong and that the controversy engulfs him and that he loses his position. Because at that point, maybe there can be dialogue. Maybe there can be a return to the Mossos d'Esquadra, the local Catalan police, policing this community. They stood by and they very gently tried to enforce the law, but beat nobody. Sometimes the local police were beaten upon by the national police themselves. It's an incredible situation. I value the fact you've given time and off the ball to this because it affected La Liga, because it affected Las Palmas, because it affected Barcelona. Probably you've got listeners who flew over for a weekend from, you know, there are countries all over the world, thousands of people, travellers, football tourists, and we're locked outside of the stadium. And we need to give a nod to the fact of what they spent, how the disappointment must feel. The confusion yesterday as they queued until it was only half an hour before kickoff that any of them knew what was happening either. It's a mess, but let me emphasise again, and I say this without fear, that the blame wholly lies with the star trooper, jackpot, thug, clockwork orange behaviour of the national police who waded in, peaceful people. And look at the footage, listeners, to Off the Ball. All the Catalans standing there, hands in the air, offering roses, no blows, no pushing, no fighting, no provocation. The idea was peaceful, and they enacted it. It was sensational. It was 1968 in Czechoslovakia, it was the Velvet Revolution, and they got beaten on, and it's wrong.
Forgive me, given a very potted history of all this, because I appreciate Catalan nationalism has been around for centuries at this stage, and you know I can read the facts and the history and see that it became a real political movement as we might know it in the 20s, and there was autonomy within Spain in the 1930s, and Franco came along, and as Franco did, he abolished all of that, and then there was a period from the late 70s on where there was a statute of autonomy of Catalonia, and really we're talking about a more modern movement. What the culmination we saw this weekend maybe dates back to about 10, 11 years ago. And again, the Spanish government passed a referendum in Catalonia. The courts are crucial here. The High Court of Justice, which seems to be very politicised, is getting involved, is rejecting different statutes. The last 5 or 6 years, we've had
a majority, a pro-independence majority in Catalonia, 2012, 2013, for the first time in the region's history. It seems, looking at all this, like we could have had much simpler solutions along the way. I mean, part of Catalonia's issue is to do, frankly, with finance as well as custom and culture. I mean, that we have got to this point seems like a complete mismanagement of the whole situation, both in these very politicised high courts and also at government level. We could talk here for 25 minutes and wouldn't scratch the surface of it, I appreciate. But it seems like a complete mess has been made of the whole situation politically over the last 15 years.
I agree with that, and I think that your thumbnail sketch is very, very good. It's difficult to speak as a qualified sociologist, but you've given me a framework where I can say I thoroughly agree with you. The 15 years I've lived here, I've seen the movement here swell in numbers, just extraordinarily. I've seen the inclusion of young, liberal, articulate, university-educated people who have taken up the baton from parts of the community who lived under Francoism. My first visit to Spain was just 7 years after, or 6.5 years after Franco had died, and it was still the case, wherever I went, that the Guardia Civil were held in fear. They weren't upholders of the law, they were agents of the state, and they literally could do what they wanted to do. Seeing that as a youngster coming from the UK, which was at that stage, it certainly felt like a democracy. It certainly felt like if you were born middle class and white, as I was, the police felt like a relatively safe body of people to be interacting with. I know that wasn't the experience of everybody, but yesterday felt like a reestablishment of those norms from 1939, when the community I live in, Barceloneta, was bombed, not quite out of existence, but to mass deaths because it was near the ports. And there are people I know who were born around then, who certainly lived the majority of their life under a regime which proved, is it Newton's law? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. You talked about, you know, what's happening and why. And one of the key things, given all the elements that you mentioned, is that if you subjugate people for many, many years, for many generations, the pendulum will swing the other way. And this has been building. Social media has changed things. Affluence has changed things. The fact that there has been wider and wider education for the community across Catalonia since 1975, when they were liberated from not being able to use their own language. Any decent sociologist would tell you this, and I'm only commenting on what I've seen from living in this community. And I'm not espousing Catalan independence. You didn't ask me, but for anybody listening who thinks I'm carrying a torch, the only torch I'm carrying for is democracy and freedom of speech, the right to choose, the right to self-determination, the right not to be oppressed by the central state, the right not to be cheated or lied about, and the right not to be beaten in your streets when you're sitting on a pavement or sitting on a stairs and seeing school doors smashed down and seeing injured people being beaten while they're being taken off for treatment. These are truths that we should hold self-evident. And, you know, for as long as I am unable to speak out about it, your breakdown of what I think is going on in society and your key point that Rajoy will have radicalized, that Rajoy will have increased the numbers of people who are willing to stand up, to vote, to campaign, that's absolutely right. This is a community of 7.5 million people, clearly not all of them are of a voting age. The calculations I've read is that about 36% of those who are eligible to vote did so. The referendum, whether, you know, in this country where jurisprudence won over prudence over this weekend, that the referendum was judged to be illegal. It also isn't comprehensive. It's not a referendum that I would feel honest or decent in saying this is definitive. It's not. What is definitive is that that game was played behind closed doors because of action that wouldn't have been out of place in the very worst of Franco's regime, and that's intolerable.
Yeah.
Graeme, you give us a good understanding there about the maybe negativity from the supporters for that game actually being played yesterday, but just give us an understanding of what FC Barcelona, what Barcelona actually means to the people then of Catalonia, and how relevant it is and how relevant the club actually is going forward, I suppose, with this fight, with this issue that's going forward over the next few years.
I think because FC Barcelona has become an international commodity. I think it's badly portrayed. I think it's badly portrayed by people who take a pot shot at it on the internet or take a pot shot at it on around the world on television or radio shows. And my honest opinion, again, having lived here for 15 years and having travelled to here for many years before that, is that the position has changed. Many, many Catalans love the club, love the football, but do they believe that this is a hotbed of independence? That do they believe that FC Barcelona is a flag bearer for Catalan self-determination? Absolutely not. Right. It's a place, the Camp Nou when Barcelona are winning, is a place where people can make a point, which is shouting for independence in the 17th minute, or which is crowing in delight if Madrid are being beaten. But do the ordinary people who are pushing for independence here in Catalonia think that the board fully represents that, their wishes or that drive? No, it's a corporate money-making scheme run by people who, I think, don't hold the same values at all as the majority of people I know or I've listened to on radio or television who are advocating independence. It's a big, fat corporate club, which for a short time was brilliantly run by a combination of people who were magic elements in the right place, whether that be Begiristain and Ferran Soriano and John Laporta and Johan Cruyff's influence culminating in Rijkaard and Guardiola taking over. And that made it seem something special. Right now, people use it. People need it as a medium. But do people think that this board or Semedo at right back or Umtiti, who's just arrived from France, that these people represent anything other than the modern game? No, I don't think they do.
Mm. Graham, thanks for all that.
It was a long one, wasn't it, lad? Sorry.
Yeah. It was worth it. It's worth it. Thanks again.
Good man. Thanks,
Graham. Worth it for democracy. Let's close on that.
Thanks. Cheers.
Off the ball on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.
So a busy football show continues. We've already brought you Graham Hunter. Coming up, we'll talk to Pat Nevin in a few moments' time. Really interesting games across the Premier League weekend. And we'll hear from David Myler, who was in really good form talking to Dave McIntyre this afternoon. Kevin Kilbane, hello.
Hi, Joe.
You are still here.
I am, of course, yeah.
So before we get to Pat Nevin, Martin O'Neill sat down for a press conference. We play Moldova on Friday, followed by Wales in Cardiff on Monday. Both games live here in the show if you can't see them on the TV. Or better still, turn down the old volume. Stick on Kilbane's insights.
That's the game. Who's it? Murphy Friday. Nathan Murphy, can't beat that.
Go to the TV Friday if you want, but come back to us on Monday. So Martin O'Neill, this is, I mean, we're at a fairly straightforward stage of the group. We have to win.
Yeah.
That's kind of the point. And this was put to Martin O'Neill in the press conference today.
I think, personally speaking, if you're going into these games now, you know what you have to do. It's a bit similar to the situation that we had in the Euros. You know, when we travelled up to Lille to play Italy, we knew we had to win the game. And I think it should focus the mind. I think that's the most important thing. Just that you have to go and win the games. They're vitally important. The first game, obviously, vitally important for us to try and win on Friday night. But I think I said this after the game against Serbia. If you'd said to me that we had to win the two games at the very, very beginning of the competition, maybe not after we'd gathered 10 points from the four games, but certainly at the beginning that we had to win the two games, we had to possibly make the playoffs, then I probably would have taken that.
Hmm. I think that's fair enough.
Yeah.
He threw in the caveat that 10 points after four games probably wouldn't have taken it then. But yeah. Here we are. In some respects, as a player, I presume it makes it more straightforward and maybe forces you to... Like we were talking at the top of the show about maybe one of the reasons we don't see the likes of the goal we saw from the Burnley trio of Brady and Ward and Hendrick. One of the reasons maybe we don't see them play as freely for country is that there is a fear factor. There's more scrutiny all week. There's more pressure. There's a negativity. Nobody wants to be the guy who screws up for their country as opposed to a Premier League game against Burnley. So maybe when you get into this must-win situation, there is a point where, I don't know, Paris away, clearly Paris would have been away, but Paris in 09 springs to mind. O'Neill referenced the Italian game there last year. There is a point where almost you think, oh look, I can't be worried about messing up. We actually just need to go and win here, and maybe you play with a bit more freedom, ironically. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's certainly a great point. And for all that I spoke about earlier on, the scrutiny that is around the team, and yeah, of course it is there, and the players do feel that, I'm convinced of that anyway, but you still enjoy it. You still do enjoy where you've got to, and you know what you've gone through to get to this place, and what you've achieved to be here. So you've still got to enjoy that as much as you can. You've still got to have that. Yes, there will be a little bit of trepidation, there will be a little bit of nerves, but how can you embrace that? And you mentioned those games, certainly the two France games, the one in Lille and the Italy game in Lille and the France game in 09 in Paris. These are the certain games when you look at, and it those games were nothing to lose, and it's kind of like, yeah, come on, let him go. Let's go out and let's go and play the way that we can play, like we saw, of course, with that goal at the weekend. Because we do have talent. We know it. We do know and we've seen it a little bit too frequently probably through this campaign, but there still is the talent there, and there still are players capable in that side of causing problems and going out and outplaying side, not necessarily going to contain sides and trying to hit them on the counter and things like this. There's certainly talent within there to do that.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the Wales game closer to Cardiff, but there is a hope maybe that they're gripped by a certain paralysis, a certain negativity. Yeah. They've got something to lose. We can go at them.
Definitely.
That's best case.
Definitely.
Scenario.
And I mean, you look at it, seeing must-win games, yeah, you would expect us to beat Moldova. Is there still a chance that we don't beat Moldova and still qualify if Wales don't? Regardless of anything, we've got to go to Wales and win that game, regardless of anything, because that's what's going to count towards our points total towards the end of the group. Moldova, of course, will be taken off, but to alleviate any doubt, you just be positive in both games. Mm. Again, we've got the players. We'll, of course, then, if we get the result Friday, we'll be then reintroducing them, Robbie Brady and James McLean, back into it. So you would hope then, with those positive mindsets coming back into it, you can go there and get a good result.
If we don't beat Moldova at home, I think we should have the decency to withdraw from the tournament.
No, there's an element, yes. Yeah. I'd take that, yeah. Yes. I'm fully with you there, yeah.
So, Harry Arter, we don't quite know about. James McCarthy, it seems, may be fit enough to feature in the second game against Wales. This is always tricky territory when a player's been missing from club action for a time and then happens to be coming back to fitness around the time of internationals. So Ronald Koeman has said he'd rather James McCarthy was not training with Ireland. O'Neill says the training can only be good for the player.
No, I would have thought, personally speaking, that I'd have thought with the length of time that James has been out, and he picked up the injuries at club level, I think that would be, I would have thought that Everton would have been quite pleased that he's, you know, just get out of the environment for a little while, you know, train with international colleagues and see how things go. And if he end up feeling pretty decent, I would have thought that would have been something that Everton would have looked forward to more than anything else.
And then one last clip. So presumably Shane Long will start up front for us and will go as planned. But O'Neill was asked if the likes of Scott Hogan and Sean Maguire, who are now in the squad, officially named in the squad, if they have a realistic shout of featuring in the game on Friday.
I don't see why not. You're talking about risk and reward. I've done it before, and I'll have a look. I'll see how the next couple of days go. And that will, generally speaking, if I know the players pretty well, then the couple of days training beforehand is not a major concern. But if I don't, and I think that there's a possibility of somebody playing, then the couple of days training become pretty important for me in terms of having a look.
Mm. To be fair to O'Neill, there have been issues with the team across this campaign.
Yeah.
We have talked, based on the performances, about a suspicion over what may not be happening from an organisational point of view in training. But if there's one thing he does do, he will pick adventurous teams.
Yes, he has done that, yeah.
Shane Long's form, he hasn't scored in 14, 15 games now. He is starting for Southampton the last couple of games.
Yeah, and he's been playing well. I've said that, has been playing well. It's just the chance he's not coming by because of the positions maybe that he's getting into playing as that lone striker. He's doing great work for the side without getting the chances, really.
It would be a brave move to take Long out of the squad now, or out of the team rather, and to put either Hogan or Maguire in? I mean, that feels like a stretch too far.
Yeah, I do. I think he will start with him. And I was just thinking in my head, it was the game, was it Wales, was it Austria, where James McCarthy hadn't been fit, and then he did the warm up, he got injured in the warm up, and then after being named in the side, I think it was Wales, was it Austria, I can't remember,
and all hell broke loose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this was then another issue going forward. But do you know what? I do agree with Martin O'Neill there totally. I think sometimes for a player, and you obviously, medical advice, you're taking it on board and things like that, but I think sometimes nowadays, I think a player will not necessarily listen to his body, they will listen to what they're being told. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you are fit, you're fine. You could, if you were playing for your club, you'd be fine to play. Why not treat playing for your country like you're playing for your club? And that's something where the clubs are always going to err on the side of caution. Yeah. They want you right. But I am in favour of that. You think, well, look, no, I'm fit. I want to play for my country. These are big games. These mean a lot to me personally. Pick up the phone sometimes. Ring your club manager and say, look, it means a lot to me. And I'm sure then if you have that conversation, I think if that conversation has not been had, that creates the issue. If you have that conversation with your manager, means a lot to me, I'm fine. If we had a club game next week, I would be fit for it. And then I don't think the club manager could have a problem with it.
Yeah, right.
But no,
Koeman, James, don't you dare play in this game.
But I know, again,
Alex Ferguson, don't you even.
Perhaps
think
a different
about
era, but I had the same problem ahead of it, and I've said it to you before. I think I've talked about this one. I'd done my ankle against Man United before the Iran game. Mick McCarthy rang me up and said, "If you're fit, you'll play." And it was about 4 or 5 weeks. I think it was about 5 weeks after I'd done my ankle. And I spoke to Peter Reid. We had the conversation all the way through. I said, look, this means too much. And he knew what it meant to me. And we had the conversation, I want to play. If I'm fit, I want to play. Yeah, no problem. You've got me blessing. And I think because I was open with him, I think he appreciated it and respected me for actually talking to him about it.
It was a Premier League weekend where some rather glistening reputations were burnished still further. Manchester City once again imperious, and Harry Kane back in the goals. We've a lot to talk to Pat Nevin about.
Good football. Ali, lovely football. Christian Eriksen here. Into Ben Davies. It's a brilliant Tottenham goal. That is an outstanding goal by Tottenham Hotspur. Kane, lovely turn away from Schindler and Jürgensen. Oh, that's fantastic. It's 3-0 and it's Harry Kane again.
Oh, he's done brilliantly, Rashford. Wonderful turn. Players waiting in the middle. It's shaken. 2.5 minutes. One matter. Here's Martial. Lukaku. Well, he's had to wait until the 86th minute for his goal today.
De Bruyne. Oh, belter. Absolute belter from Kevin De Bruyne. There is no stopping that.
Arfield now. Onto his left foot, needs a little bit of a run. Gets one from Stephen Ward. His cut back to Jeff Hendrick. Jeff Hendrick makes a space. Oh, he puts it into the bottom corner. That's a fantastically worked goal from Burnley. And it had Ireland all over it. Jeff Hendrick combining with Stephen Ward. And Burnley take the lead. 21 minutes played. Everton 0, Burnley 1.
But again, the Brazilian Coutinho picks it up. You know he's going to try and get it onto his right foot and get the shot off, which he does. Oh, Philippe Coutinho, he's done it again. That is a cracking ball straight through the middle, and there could be a chance for Yasalu to equalise. Oh, Matip gets back, makes the tackle, but it doesn't matter because it's into the back of the net. Newcastle United are level. What a ball from John Joe Shelby.
Pat Nevin, come in.
I'm here, don't worry, I've not gone anywhere.
I'd probably like to pull Nathan up on that cracking ball through Liverpool's defence. I don't think it was too hard of a ball to play through to Hosselu against Liverpool that day. I don't feel so.
Aided by the two cones standing motionless and watching helplessly.
A little bit of that, yeah, I think so, yeah.
We were going to start in Chelsea Man City, and let's ultimately do that, but that was some of the worst defending. It was just really strange. Did they not see it? Did they not sense the danger? Did they freeze? It was hard to work out what was going on.
I think so often when you're watching Liverpool now, how often do you see Liverpool's defence, more so the back two or the two centre halves, chasing back towards their own goal? We had it with Arsenal. We had an issue with Arsenal doing it regularly up the last few seasons as well. They've had that. Constantly running back towards their own goal suggests, you know, out of position, bad body shape to start, getting caught out, a little bit too flat. We've seen it too often from them, really, haven't we?
Yeah. Lovren and Matip we're talking about here, obviously, Pat.
Yeah. I mean, one of the problems you've got with Liverpool, and it's a kind of problem I kind of almost accept from them, because they're ultra positive. They want to send as many players forward as possible. And those old defenders, they like a little bit of help. They like somebody kind of marking in front, you know, and a fullback always likes to drag a winger back in front to give them a little bit of help. Centre-backs, they're desperate to have one or two sitting midfielders right in front of them so they can cover them. And then you get someone like Klopp or Pep comes in and said, no, you two defend.
Mm.
Right? You've got a couple of players or one player to look after. You deal with that. And it's kind of, it went out of fashion for a long time. Now, that's not Liverpool's only problem, because dogs and cats in the street are well aware of the fact that they can't defend corners or free kicks as well. However, that side of it, we are saying, right, okay, 1-1. I watch Pep's, you know, asking Stones, right, okay, 1-1, I expect you to do it. And he's getting better at doing it. It's hard, it's difficult, because some of the centre forwards around are pretty damn good. Some of the strikers are pretty damn good. But at the moment, Liverpool haven't got good enough defenders to go man to man.
Pat, I just wanted to say within that, but that's not new. That you would have seen that. You would have seen defenders almost like a little bit more cautious on the half turn, ready to almost get into a sprint with the striker. So they're almost like get that yard or two ahead of the striker to start with. If it's a quick striker, sometimes there isn't too much you can do about it. But you see, the one thing you'll see with Liverpool, there is absolutely no thought for that ball being played in behind you as it is. Even when there's no pressure on the ball, just you need to look at the weekend, see how flat they were as a pairing. Very, very wide. And as soon as that ball, I was obviously joking with Nathan before, but it's not a difficult ball just to play a lad in behind. And he was right on the edge, he was, Oslo, to be fair to him. But you just look how flat they are, and then that reaction, how late it is. That's the thing.
Can I ask you a very quick question there, and Pat, pick up on Kevin's point, and then we will get to Chelsea Man City, because it was such an amazing game. I think it was Klopp made the point that he wanted them to spot the danger and both to step up. To me, I don't know, there's different schools of thought. Why not just go with the runner when it's 2v1? Why take the risk of even stepping up? Why can't they just get on the turn early, spot the danger, go with the runner? Nothing bad can realistically happen then. Like, I don't even like
No pressure on the ball. No pressure on the ball, you cannot step up. That's just a given.
Okay, well, that's a worry then, because Klopp wanted them to step up. Okay,
remember Arsenal did that. They were brilliant at it. But tell you what, that was hours and hours and hours and hours of training and working on it every single day.
Yeah. Which Liverpool clearly aren't doing.
And well, obviously. Obviously.
So the easy thing today, then you would say, well, just one of you or both of you go with the runner, spot the runner, both of you go with it. I mean, that just really didn't seem like a tricky one to solve there.
No, I have to say, now and again, defenders just, they get it wrong. Sure. I mean, that's why you get goals, they get it wrong. But with Liverpool, they're not awful all the time. That's not the point. But like a number of teams, the teams, you don't even need to say it. Who are the teams that are spending the vast majority of the time thinking of how to create, and who are the ones that are thinking of how to destroy? And you're looking at West Brom, know how to destroy. Stoke for a long time were absolutely fantastic. Burnley, as we watched at the weekend, fantastic at it. And that's what they do. They base it in that, and everything else comes from that. Whereas you look at certain other teams, be it Man City, be it Liverpool, and one or two others, actually, and Arsenal to some degree these days, who have gone, flipped at 180 degrees, and it's, all right, we'll create first and we'll worry about the rest of it later.
Mm.
Some point, people are going to realise it ain't a dichotomy. You can actually do both. it's possible to do both of them. But it seems that there are some people out there that seem to think, some managers and coaches even, that seem to think it's kind of a dirty word to say that, there's two sides to the team, even three sides, but two actual different positions you have to take. Now, they were working defending at some point, we're not saying that at all, but putting the same amount of emphasis on it, the thought and consideration into it, you need to do that.
Some of the stats from Manchester City's 1-0 win over Chelsea. City had 62% possession, they had 17 shots to Chelsea's four. Double the number of corners. Conte went with, it turned out to be five at the back, but a 3-5-1-1 was the general reading of it today. But
it was definitely five at the back. 100% it was five at the back.
They were just wedged back, that back five, and under pressure. Much of the talk in commentary, Pat, I don't know, were you at the game or did you watch on television?
I was at the game, no.
Okay, well, much of the talk on TV was Glenn Hoddle very focused and impressed with the way City were shaping up, and it was almost like you had the new age manager in Guardiola completely outsmarting Conte in some respects. One of the key things he thought was very striking was that rather than overlapping Kyle Walker and Fabian Delph went on the inside tram line and kept going up and down on the inside, and there was a complete overload across the pitch, and Chelsea couldn't figure out how to handle all these bodies around the place. So could you talk to us about your sense of that?
Well, yeah, the underlapping thing is something a number of people have been rather good at. Leighton Baines was quite good at it for a little while there as well. I mean, we know Everton were very good at that. And that's one side of it. The movement of them up front was incredibly good. But Chelsea kind of said, look, we accept that. That's going to happen. You know, we'll sit back. We'll have the five. We'll have the, you know, certainly two to stroke three players in front of them. So it was a 5-3-2. The concept being, you still have to get around us. You still have to get through us. And by the way, if we hit it up to the two that we've got up front, we think we'll leave you two and you'll leave us 2-2. And we rate our two against your two.
Mm.
I don't think it was much more complicated about that. I think that was Conte's thinking. And beforehand, I was thinking, you know what? You know, that just might work. Because if you go open against Manchester City, everybody that plays open against them buckles at the moment. Completely buckles. They end up Liverpool end up losing five. Yes, they were down a man, but others have lost fives and sixes this season. So his thinking I got, and I fully and utterly understood. But they just couldn't get out. Now, you gave some stats there. Was it 68-32? Is that right? The
62-38. Yeah.
That's really unfair. I was at the game. It was much more than that. The only reason why it felt that positive towards Chelsea, by the way, and it's not positive for a home team, is because in the last 15 minutes, Chelsea got a lot more of the ball. It was more one-sided than even you're suggesting there. But the idea and the concept was like, okay, we'll soak this up, we'll soak this up, and we'll break on you. But they never got any breaks at all, Chelsea. And the biggest thing that, I mean, lots of technical things. It was a really interesting technical match for a vast number of reasons. And it was would have been a joke had Chelsea won that. And I'm saying it from a very blue perspective here. It's absolutely true. It would have been a joke if Chelsea had won that. But in actual fact, they could have just about sneaked a point out of it because they got those little chances at the end. And the one thing, and if I could find one weakness, because they were so good, Manchester City, and I adored watching them so much, and I have this season so much. One thing, their pace and closing down high up the park was astonishing. I mean, right up there, the best you've ever seen. It was unbelievable. Chelsea couldn't live with it, couldn't get near it. And about 15 minutes ago, I realised they're not superhuman. And then they began to fade just a little bit.
Mm.
But most teams by that time in the game are 3, 4, and 5 down against Manchester City. Chelsea were only one down. They could have sneaked it back. In reality, without, you know, their best left back, without their best centre forward, they were still miles ahead of Chelsea. Miles ahead.
Mm. I think the one thing as well, you were saying with closing down, pressing further up the pitch as well, was that with that start-off point from Courtois, when you see Chelsea, the way that they start, split the two centre-halves, obviously then you try and get more advanced players in positions when it comes back to Courtois, you can hit a diagonal ball. But the way that City had pressed them, they nullified that straight away. So then Courtois thinking, I don't want to get caught here. He nearly got caught by Jesus really early, didn't he?
There was three occasions they were caught, yeah.
Yeah.
Three occasions caught in their own box.
And that was the one. I think it just gets in the mind then, and all of a sudden, whatever you've worked on through the week, City have obviously, the game plan's perfect.
Yeah.
It goes out the window, doesn't it, from Chelsea's perspective?
It seemed in particular, I mean, not that Sané was isolated or anything, but it seemed in particular that the trio of Walker and De Bruyne and Sterling realised they were onto a good thing very early on.
Well, they didn't have to defend in any ways because the way Chelsea set up, they set up, as you say, with the five at the back. You know, Azpilicueta goes to the right wing-back stroke full-back position. So he wasn't even thinking of getting forward at any point in time. So they realised, wait a minute, all we need to do is thinking about going forward here.
Mm.
Now, as the striker, everybody loves that concept of not all your energy will only be expended in one direction. And it's great if you're always on the ball all the time. Now, to be fair, you talk about those 17 shots and goal, they weren't that many absolutely golden chances that were created for it. But if you keep on making that amount of them, you're going to get one. Something's going to get through. And to be fair, for all the fact that I'm impressed with Sané, I don't think Sané had the greatest of games, but he was always a danger. And you knew half a moment that, you know, any one of those strikers would do it. Jesus would do it. Somebody would do it. De Bruyne, possibly the most likely at the moment to do it. But had Aguero been on the field there, I mean, the game would have been finished by half time. By some distance. It just shows you how far they were ahead of it. I'm waxing lyrical. I was doing it for Chelsea TV, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not going to lie here.
Yeah.
It's going to tell you they're miles ahead just now. But don't write off Conte. He has spotted a lot of things, and he's learned a massive amount. And he kind of is the the type of bloke that, you know, he'll learn a lot in a defeat. And I can see him when he just about changed it. I don't know if you noticed, but just before City scored, he was on the verge of changing it. He had the subs for about 2 or 3 minutes standing on the side, wanting to adapt it, because I think he felt as if that little bit of tiredness that I was talking about was beginning just to show. And if they're not closing down at that level, suddenly the gaps will appear. But he didn't get those players on quick enough to adapt it and change it. After that, you know, after the goal, City have done the job and Chelsea were a little bit better, but still they weren't the better side. You know, it was a joy to watch. And if you're going to gauge it on that game, or most of the games this season, City are miles ahead just now and improving.
Duncan Castles in the Sunday Times yesterday said that Conte is potentially eyeing up going at the end of the season, that he is unhappy with the transfer business done in the summer, that he finds Abramovich inaccessible, which doesn't overly shock me. But on Pat's point, Kev, it's like you guys have spoken to each other beforehand, because Kev came in and Pat just talked about the same stuff, Kev, that this Manchester City performance, the quality, like the likes of Silva and De Bruyne are just literally not putting a foot wrong, that this is, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but this is pretty much as good as it gets in the Premier League.
And Pat spoke about something there. I was watching it on TV.
Yeah.
You can tell the difference sometimes. I think you'd made a reference early on to the Palace United game and then watching that one. The pace on the game.
Yeah.
And when Pat's at it, it's almost like it's a notch up again. You'll go and watch games. We were at the game yesterday, Pat, weren't we, at Everton-Burnley. And the pace on the game compared to that one on Saturday evening, it's chalk and cheese. It's a total contrast. That's the thing that's very, very notable watching that game. Whenever I've watched City this season as well, the real pace that they play at, it's very difficult for sides to contain that. And I referenced it earlier, I suppose, as well. You look at Chelsea getting that result midweek, last midweek against Atletico Madrid.
Yeah.
It starts to put you in your mind now, where can Man City get to, given how well they played against Chelsea and how they dominated them, where can they get to in the Champions League this season? Because the way that they're going, they're not far off it. In my mind, they're not far off it. You know, that the real top echelon there, the real top clubs, and we'll see. If Guardiola can get it right, if he can keep everybody right. Mendy, I think that might be an issue for him with... Yeah. With the left back position, with Fabian Delph playing there.
Yeah, there to come as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's one thing I'm ever wanting to ask you about, Pat. Delph played well against Shakhtar. He's played well at the weekend, but he is no Mendy, and that could be a problem. And of course, then you've got Aguero out for the next 6 weeks or so as well.
It could be a problem, but it didn't look like a problem against Chelsea. You know, and Delph, I have to say, and he's got a little bit of injury as well, I believe, just now. He's just stepped down from the England squad for coming up this today. But in actual fact, his energy was fantastic. And you don't, okay, he's not Mendy, but nobody's Mendy, you know, what he adds to the team. But he'll add something else that's absolutely fine. So to be honest, I think there's enough depth in that squad now. It looks as if there is enough depth in that squad. By the way, if any of you get a chance, if anybody listening gets a chance, give a look at those average positions that you get, you know, at the end of a game.
I've got it in front of me.
Oh, he's ahead of you, Pat.
Have you ever seen anything like that for Manchester City? It's just a circle.
It's a perfect circle.
Two players in the middle. Yeah. It's unbelievable. And it really, really tells you something. That absolutely is not a fluke, is it? Mm. That's not a fluke. That's a totally in a different way of looking at it. And you can't get near it. And you look at Chelsea's in comparison.
Yeah.
And it's just a normal sort of 3-5-2, 5-3-2. You know, you can see that a mile away.
Yeah.
How on earth do you deal with that circle that we were talking about?
It's very true. I'll hold it up for you, Kevin. I know you've seen it already.
Yeah, I see it in front of me here. It's around the centre circle, isn't it?
It is like a warm-up game of training where you have two lads in the middle.
Yeah.
It is. I have never, ever seen anything like that. The only thing that surprises me is that the goalkeeper isn't in that circle as well.
So we've got to give this formation a name, you know?
Do you know what Joe was saying to me before?
I'm calling it the nucleus, by the way.
The nucleus, there you go.
Yeah,
there you go. See, that's the kind of touch of class that you bring, you know? Yeah. With the Christmas tree, no, the nucleus.
I can't bring that. I cannot touch that. That's the thing. That's the difference. It is a difference.
Kev's signaling was piggy in the middle.
But, you know, we Joe and I were talking early on, Pat. We were talking about how you get Jesus and Aguero into the side, and he has played with the four at times this season. He's played with the three predominantly to get the two in the side as a pairing up front. But it's not necessarily a system with him, is it? It's not necessarily. He's not going to look. We're not going to play the traditional 4-1-4-1 system. We're not going to play a traditional 3-5-2 or whatever. However you do it, it's a total different system to any other system we'll see.
there were a few times in my career, in my early days in Chelsea, I had a manager that said to me, do you know what, son, you're good enough, just do it. Just go out there, you know where the weaknesses are, go and find them. And do you know what, he's got about six players there that he's probably just said, you know where the weaknesses are, go out and find them. And it's totally adaptable. I mean, we talked about it last week, the fact that have a look at the average position of De Bruyne each week. And 1 week's playing right, 1 week's playing left, 1 week's playing centre, 1 week a little bit further forward. It just changes their position. They're all totally and utterly adaptable within it, with the possible exception of Jesus, who's a bit further forward, and Aguero.
Yeah.
But then even he's beginning to adapt his game just before he gets injured as well.
Okay, that's interesting. Because I was going to ask you as a kind of final point, the likes of Walker and Delph playing on the underlap, as you call it, and this kind of weird perfect circle for whatever reason. I was going to ask you how preordained and regimented you suspect all that is, but you seem to say it's go out and find the weaknesses and play off each other and a lot more freewheeling than people might think.
Yeah, well, we're back to Barcelona. They're very best, aren't we?
Yeah.
You know, you know the players that have to, you know, defenders, probably two of them there. There'll be one guy in front of them who will be the controlling sort of influence in that defensive area. So if someone breaks to the right, he'll go over and cover a bit there and allow people to get back. If you've got very, very fit players, enough guys will get back to kill that. But in the fact that you've probably got 70 to 80% of the play anyway, you're not going to be attacked that often.
Yeah.
So the concepts, although it sounds complex to us, you know, to someone who's thinking of it in those terms and has grown up in those terms, it's not really. It's just the way we do it. We will overload. We will find intelligent enough players to overload. It's not a fluke that Messi goes and scores every week and two and three goals every week. It's because he knows where to go and find the weaknesses. He'll just go and weigh up positions, teams that are playing against, the weakness of any player, and just, well, I'll be there.
Yeah.
And get there. He's got players that are beginning to do that at City now.
Yeah, very interesting. Pat, thanks a million for that.
Thanks, Pat.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Pat Nevin there. We are hearing from David Myler next.
Off the ball.
In association with AIR. Don't miss live and exclusive Premier League action this month on the AIR Sport Pack.
This is News Talk.
So David Myler was speaking at the launch of EA Sports' FIFA 18, which is out now. Pick up your match programme in the Aviva when Republic of Ireland meet Moldova and find out how you can win a copy of the game and take on the Irish international. That's David Myler face to face. So Dave McIntyre went out to see him today, and here's how they got on.
David, we're here to talk about FIFA 18 and the fact that gaming seems to be a major part of your life. I haven't owned a console in quite some time, so this kind of level of the craze has passed me by, but I was looking at your YouTube channel, 230,000 subscribers to essentially watch you play a computer game. That's something that will go over the heads of a lot of people. How do you find the time for a start? Because I know you have a young child as well, to get all this gaming done.
I think my daughter goes to bed between 7 and half 7, and then my fiance goes to bed between 7:30 and 8. And I don't know many Irish families that go to bed quite early. So from 8 o'clock till best part of 11, I'm free to play. So I'll shoot a video or I'll play online and just, you know, that's the way it is.
So the videos, like, you're editing them yourself. Like, you seem to have the whole mix down.
I'm not editing
are you not? No.
Anymore, no.
No. I did start myself.
But when I started a YouTube channel, I never actually realised how difficult, like, video editing, shooting videos, all that stuff actually is. And then I've had some help from an Irishman, Aidan, who does all the videos now. So he makes them look spectacular. It's not me. So I can't take credit for it.
Is that a part of that you'd like to learn about and to actually be able to do this kind of stuff yourself as the years go on?
Probably. I do know how to do it. I started to do it, but that's the time-consuming part. Like, Aidan was telling me one day that I sent him a video that was 2 hours long, and, you know, he was cutting it down to 25 minutes, and it took him 4.5 hours to edit it. Right. So that's the time-consuming part, but he's an expert at it, I'm not, so I'm happy for him to do it, and I think he's happy to do it.
A lot of people still see it as time ill-spent, just playing a computer game, which is probably the lazy way of looking at it, but when you see the industry that's grown up around it, around gaming, there's even some, I don't know if it's half-hearted talk, that video gaming, of some description, could be an Olympic sport someday. There's conventions and there's huge events that are built up around gaming. Do you think it's something that post-football you could see yourself getting involved in as a post-playing career?
I've been asked this question before. Look, I enjoy playing now. I'd be more of a kind of, I'm living in the moment, kind of, I plan to play till I'm at least 36 anyway. Like at the time then my daughter will be 9. So who knows? But while I'm playing and while I'm enjoying, I enjoy playing, you know, computer games or whatever. It's because it's just, so it's a different hobby. You know, some fellas turn, some professional footballers turn to drink, some turn to gambling. I've managed to turn to FIFA. So, you know, everyone has different ways of doing things.
Do you find it relaxes you when you're playing, a nice way of winding down after a game or after training or after a long team meeting about an upcoming game or a video session, that other people when they're playing computer games, they almost find themselves more wound up when they finish playing than they were before they started? How do you find yourself after them?
Depends how well I do. But I can see what you're saying, because some days you can get stressed out playing. Like on a weekend, there's a big thing called the Foot Champions Weekend League. That's a big thing for any tournaments that they have on. You've got they'll do it over, say, the space of a month. You'll have four weekends. So you've got to play 160 games. So it's 40 games a weekend.
Jesus.
Yeah. So that starts at Friday, 7 o'clock in the morning, finishes Monday, 7 o'clock in the morning. So you've got to get 40 games in between. But then, like, some people look at it and go, wow, that's so much FIFA. But then if you break it down, you have the time. Then if you do it rightly, it's actually not that much at all. But then I know a lad from England who won 200 grand recently in FIFA. He won the FIFA Interactive World Cup. So there are huge opportunities in it. But obviously to get to that level is something totally different.
You'd want to devote yourself full time to it almost. Was it David James a few years ago, well over 10 years ago now, that blamed a couple of mistakes against Manchester United when he was in goal for Liverpool on the fact that he'd spent most of the previous night gaming? Does it affect you in any way in terms of fatigue or lying in bed and you're seeing players racing down the wing and trying overhead kicks into the top corner? Like, once you've stopped playing, is that the end of it? Doesn't actually affect you in any other way or your mood or anything?
Look, it doesn't, no. I can't believe that David James would play in a computer game. Do you know what I think? Like, in England, international has to be professional in the sense of, like, if that's true, if that city's come out, because I've got to know when to draw the line. I can't be up the night before a game for 4 or 5 hours playing FIFA. It's not good for me. It's not good preparation. Look, I'm 28 years of age. I'm a professional. I know how to look after myself and, you know, prepare correctly. So I play when the time is right. I don't play when I shouldn't, really.
As you say, you're 28 now, and like, you've been through so much in your career. You've missed such big chunks of your career through injury. You've changed clubs a couple of times. You went over so late. Like, it's a brilliant story that you have to tell. But looking at your stats, I think you've played almost 140 league games for Hull now. And would I be right in saying that you're comfortably the most comfortable in your career now that you've ever been, in terms of how settled you are, how established in the team you are, the leadership role that you're playing with Hull, and you're getting increasing roles with Ireland as well?
Yeah, I think I've 144 league games, and I think I've completed 173, 74 games in total for Hull. Yeah, I'm comfortable. You know, I have my house, I have my missus, I have my daughter. But then I flip side the coin, I'm out of contract in the summer. Yeah, the club have an option or whatever, but, you know, you talk about, well, I'm comfortable, I'm really enjoying it, I like being at Hull, but look, it's football, you never know what's going to happen.
Assuming that you're injury free, whose court is the ball in when it comes to what the next move is? Is it you that will assess your options as a free agent come January, or is it the club that you're waiting on to come and put something on the table for you?
Well, my representative has spoken to Hull, so we'll see that. You know, it's, I wouldn't say the ball is in my court or the ball's in their court. I think, like, I want to do what's best for me and the club want to do what's best for them. You know, if they want me to stay, I'm happy to stay. If they don't, then I say thank you for the last 5 years and away we go.
I guess your ultimate goal is to be playing as a Premier League midfielder again, isn't it? And the way things are going right now, it doesn't look too likely that Hull will be in the Premier League next season, although there's an awful long way to go in the season. We've seen clubs, Roy Keane, Sunderland in particular, come from nowhere to shoot all the way up to the top of the table. But that's the ultimate ambition, I get, whether or not it's Hull that can help you achieve that.
I think every player has to, you know, push themselves. Yeah, I want to play. I want to be back playing the Premier League. I played 110 times in the Premier League. I want to be back playing there. I don't want to be playing in the Championship. I think if anyone's happy to say, "Oh, I'm happy to play in Championship," then, you know, then they're kidding themselves, because the Premier League is where you want to play. You want to be playing at Anfield, Old Trafford, Stamford Bridge, the Emirates, you know, the Etihad, they're the kind of stadiums you want to be going to. You know, you want to be going playing, testing yourselves against, you know, your Pogba, your David Silva's, your Aguero's, you know, all those players. They're the people you want to be playing against, because, you know, they push you to get more out of yourself and, you know, get to a higher level.
When you're playing FIFA and you're up against these guys in whatever game you're playing or whatever tournament you might happen to be playing at the time, do you have those kind of thoughts yourself as well? Like, you're reminded that I'm actually a professional footballer and I can be back in a position where I'm actually playing for real against these dudes?
People always say to me, like, "Oh, do you learn anything about the players like I'm playing against from FIFA?" And I said, "No." But, like, then I have other kids who watch and kind of say, like, "Yeah." Like, people forget at times. I grew up as a football fan too. You know, I grew up, I supported Liverpool growing up. Do you mean Steven Gerrard was my favourite player? Well, I say him and Roy Keane were my favourite players, because obviously Roy was from Cork. So even though I didn't like Man U, but obviously Roy was from Cork. But, you know, people, FIFA is so different than, like, real football. You know, it's a computer game at the end of the day. You know, you can just hold a button and the player runs all day. It don't work like that in real life. Like, you know,
I don't know if you're taking the piss out of me now or not, saying that.
No, I'm not.
That FIFA is nothing like real football. Obviously, it's not. Like, it's a computer game.
Yeah, of course. But you see, people think they're very similar. Yeah, that's the. No, I'm not taking the mick. Like, but people say to me, "Oh, do you study players? Say, if we're playing, I don't know, before in the past, we've been playing Chelsea in the weekend, and you might be playing against Chelsea players." On people ask me, "Do you study the players' ratings on FIFA?" And I says, "No, because it's totally different." Like, I don't mean that as in it's virtual and it's a real, but, like, you know, people think that, like, I'd look at cards of certain players and be like, oh, I know he's strong and he's fast, so. But,
as opposed to watching actual film of these guys you're going to be playing against at the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Correct. So, but that's probably the younger generation.
You're on pens. When did that happen?
Played Wolves. Was the second or third game of the season, and our striker Abel Hernandez was on penalties and he got injured and he'll be out for a while, and got a penalty in the game, and I'm seen as one of the inverted commas leaders, so I just took the ball and said, "I'm taking him." Scored, the manager said, "Next game, penalties, Myler." So,
and you've popped another one in since then. You're on three already. So when Abel comes back, is there going to be a little bit of a Cavani-Neymar situation?
No. Abel's our penalty taker. I have no problem. Abel's the penalty taker. But if you don't want to take him, I'll take him.
If you've knocked in 10 in a row, like, without the keeper getting close to it, you're still not happy to have that fight with him?
No. He's the penalty taker. So, look, who am I kidding? You know, if I'm going to be... I'm not going to argue with him. He's our top striker. He's been our top scorer in the last few seasons. He's our penalty taker. Do you know? Yeah, if I come along and take a few penalties, but I would probably never have taken a penalty if he hadn't have been injured. So it's just the way it is.
Massive week, obviously. All of you guys are home for the games against Moldova and Wales, both alive and off the ball, it should be said. The way your position in the squad at the moment, and given the injuries as well, like, you're in a really good place as a potential starter on Friday and then on Tuesday evening. Do you feel you're at a level within the Republic of Ireland squad now that maybe you haven't been before, that, like, you're always going to be very close to being a starter in centre midfield? So many of your caps have been coming from the bench, or you've been part of so many squads where you haven't seen a minute of play?
Yeah, but I think I've got to look at myself. You know, if I'm going to be brutally honest, I've got to look at myself and have I done enough to earn more game time, or if you want to put it as more and more caps, if I trained well enough. You know, I've spoken to my dad about it before and I've gone through it. Have I done enough? And I probably haven't, in the sense of, you know, I needed to do more, and the opportunities that you get in games, you need to do more.
Look, for example, the Vienna game. Like, you came off the bench early in that game and were brilliant. You were part of the goal. It was probably the best performance in what has been a group of fairly average performances so far, and yet you're not an automatic starter after that. Like, some would say, well, that's an example of where Myler did make the most of his opportunity and he still doesn't get what would seem to be a fair crack at the whip going forward.
Yeah, look, you can look at it every different way. you know, wasn't just me who played that night, like, in the sense of, you know, everyone else did well as well. It was a good result. But, you know, I've worked under the manager at club level. I know how he works. He picks a team he feels is going to go out and win the game. Now, obviously, I want to be in that team, so does everybody else. But when he picks a team, you respect that and you have to get on with it. There's no point in sitting there holding grudges or anything. I want to play the minute of every game. I think everybody does. But sometimes it doesn't always happen like that.
Things have never been more clear-cut when it comes to what we need to do in these two games. Often there's a lot of talk around this team that if a draw would appear to be a half-decent result, almost certainly we usually end up with a draw. There are one or two games where we win or one where we might lose, which was the Serbia example. But knowing that you're going into two games where nothing other than 6 points matters, even if Wales are beaten by Georgia, it makes no odds to us because of the position that we're in. Focuses the mind, I would have thought. Makes everything very, very clear as to what has to be done.
Yeah. Look, I think if you had said at the start of the group, if we're in this situation, we have two games left to win the two games. But first and foremost, we need to take care of Moldova. There's no point in talking about, you know, a Monday's game or nothing. We need to prepare for Friday and take care of business. We need to be as professional as ever. It was difficult when we played them away, but we need to be bang at it. And, you know, before we even consider talking about Wales, we need to beat Moldova and get 3 points.
One final question, David. I was on commentary with Kevin yesterday at Goodison Park. You've seen the goal, I'm sure. Have you, Jeff Hendricks' goal? The interplay, firstly, this like incredible sweeping crossfield pass from Robbie. It ends up at the feet of Stephen and a wonderful little bit of intricate combination play between Stephen and Jeff Hendrick. And Hendrick's first touch was worldly and then the finish was just so calm. The first thing I said after the replays of the goal was to Kevin was, you see the interplay between Stephen Ward and Jeff Hendrick there. Why do we see that kind of football so seldom when these lads are wearing a green jersey? And you may disagree with me, because obviously it's almost a personal dig at you because you're a member of that squad, but I would be among a lot of fans that feel that there's far more football and far more skill and guile in the Ireland squad and the collective players than we see in most games.
Yeah, but that's down to the players. You spoke about, yeah, Robbie picks up a ball and he switches it to Wardy. That's on Robbie to pick up the ball in the game. For Ireland to do the same thing. You know, the manager wants us to go out and play football. He wants us to go out and be on the front foot, get on the ball and make something happen. But that's on us, you know, when you go out. Like, if I speak on my own personal behalf, we played Preston last week at Hull and we sat too deep and we didn't get on the ball. And then second half, we went on the front foot, and we went at them and players got in the other players' faces and we all got in the ball. But then the manager would turn to us and go, well, why didn't you do it in the first half? So that's on, I think that's got to be on us to go.
So why didn't you do it in the first half?
I don't know. Like, I couldn't put my finger on it, you know, but I think it's the same. It's on the players to go out and be, like, grab the bull by the horns and, you know, get on the ball. It's responsibility, it's leadership, it's characters. You know, you've got to go and you've got to do it. It's on us, though. Look, once the manager picks his team, we go across that white line, you know, if it's 3 o'clock on a Saturday or 7:45 on a Monday or Friday. Once you cross that white line, you have to go and you have to produce. It's 11v11 and, you know, you've got to go and you've got to make something happen because, you know, there's only 11 players on the pitch that can.
And did it take a bit of an ear bashing from the manager at halftime of that whole Preston game for you guys to get on the front foot coming out?
No, it didn't.
You know yourselves.
We knew ourselves it wasn't good enough.
You know, why doesn't it happen? Like, you realise that you're way too deep, you can't get in the ball and you're being dominated 15 minutes in. Why can't it happen then?
In a sense, it's one of football's great mysteries. It just seems to be confidence reason that they're kind of like, oh, we're up against it here, let's just sit in. But yeah, there are periods in games where it does look, we're going to dominate a team, then you're not going to score, you might score. It's usually when you tend to score, then you kick on, you get another one. But then if you don't, you kind of tend to drop back and then they get on top of you. But that's down to us. You know, you spoke there about the Irish lads at Burnley who've been doing really well. They've gone and they've created something. That's on them to go, and it's on me, it's on them, it's on the rest of the squad to go and, you know, do that in games.
Brilliant stuff, Dave. Really appreciate it, and the very best of luck over the next week.
Thank you very much.
Off the Ball on News Talk.
In association with the Air Sport app, allowing you to cast your favourite sporting action from your tablet or mobile phone straight to your TV.